One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hello and welcome to this. It is the Infrequent Flying Podcast pilot episodes. As always, I'm joined by Dunk, Parco and Godders, but of course we're not here to talk to those three because today we have not one, but two special guests. I think I'll go with you, Parco. Introduce our first special guest.
Indeed. Yes. Yeah, so with me is my son, number two son, James, who's just finished elementary flying training at Cranwell and did his last trip with Dunk Mason.
Wow. Wow.
Right. Is he still in therapy?
You've seen somebody, haven't you?
Only a couple of hours of therapy.
But we only did it on Friday as well. He's already booked himself in.
Hang on. So you said the last trip. Did he chop you, James, or did you finish the course?
Imagine if he chopped you.
He allowed me to finish, actually, very kindly.
Good lad. That doesn't happen often.
Exactly. And for our second special guest, I'll let Godders do the honours.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure to be able to say hello after a minor Skype faff to Dave Warrington, who is an old boss of mine. Where when I was bringing the F-35 into service, he was the F-35 force commander. But before that, Dave joined the Air Force just after Parky, it seems like, about 50 years ago in 1985, a Tornado pilot. And that's part of the reason that Dave's on here this evening. And then station commander up at Cranwell, and like I say, you know, one of the last jobs in F-35, and now working for CAE on the outside, so has got all sorts of views. Dave, hello, good to see you.
Hey, Connors, yeah, it's great to see you. I'm parking Duncan, and of course meet James as well, and JB. So interesting to hear James's stories, you know, for what it's like to be a youngster sort of going through. It only seemed like yesterday, but a long time since I was in that same position.
Yeah, it was a couple of years ago. We'll get into it in a minute. But, you know, the reason you're on here, we spoke to Nick Hurd the other week, 30 years on from the Gulf War, of which you were involved in. And we'll get your story in a minute. We'll leave everyone on tenterhooks just for the moment, because we haven't said hello to Dunk yet.
Hello.
Well, he's not got a special guest, has he? He didn't bring one.
Technically, he shouldn't be here.
No, he's got that sock puppet.
Hello, everyone. Yeah, nice to see you. Yeah, it was an absolute pleasure going flying with Jamesy. It was more of a pleasure for me, probably, than it was for him, given that it was his final handling test or final nav test. But we where did we go, Jamesy? Tell everyone where we went.
So we went up north around Leeds, Bradford, and then went through the dams, did the dams run, which was awesome, and then popped back out to Cranwell. So it was a great, great trip. Great fun, and the weather was perfect. So the weather was get perfect. Lost.
What were you flying, James?
Pardon, sorry?
What were you flying?
The Prefect is what the EFT's done at the moment.
Ah, nice. Yeah.
So just to focus on what James has been doing, so James is in the Army, as it turns out, but he's going to go and fly...
Good God!
Yeah.
Christmas is very awkward in the bar.
But there was another little, I think I'm right in saying, James, you were saying that was the last Army trip from 57 Squadron. Is that correct?
Correct, yes.
So that was the last Army flight. And now they're not going to go through elementary training as I understand, they're just going to go straight to Shawbury. That right, James?
Yeah, correct. So there's one course behind me, but they're actually at Barkston on the Navy squadron there. Yeah. So I was the last one up Cranwell.
So I imagine you got a great picture of that last historic event, Doug.
We did. We've got a fantastic picture, which we'll post on the Twitter feed.
So I've just got a quick question then, James. Are you aware of any differences in traditions which you're aware of between Army flyers and the RAF?
There's slight differences. I think EFT for us Army students is a little bit less stressful because we all know that we're going rotary, so there's no other streams for us. Whereas the RAF guys and the Navy guys all get streamed, and now kind of EFT is getting shorter, they get streamed on less hours, so it can become quite stressful if you really want jets or you really want a certain platform.
But you really want rotary wing, yeah?
Yeah, the rotary is popular at the moment.
Excellent stuff. Excellent.
Actually, I bet all of us, pains us to say, I mean, Duncan and Goddard would have done some helicopter time when they went before the Harrier, which I know we've talked about it before, you utterly loved. You know, Dave, have you flown any helicopter, got your stickies on those bad boys?
Yeah, from passenger flying and stuff. But yeah, it's great fun. Yeah, I had the pleasure of flying the Wessex for a couple of days
down
in Cyprus when the Wessex was a hoot and a roar, sort of, you know, landing on beaches and doing all that sort of stuff. And
wasn't it a hoot and a roar with 84?
Yeah, exactly.
Wasn't 84 squadron hoot and a roar with 84?
I'm pretty sure it was 84, Doug, but I wouldn't bet my life on it. It was a squadron that was in Cyprus that took me flying on a helicopter. So
I think a lot of us have that secretly. We'd never admit it, obviously, in public, like on a podcast, but very cool helicopters. And I definitely see the attraction of flying those things. Must be brilliant.
Well, I was at Barton Aerodrome on Sunday, which is another story entirely. But I've got to say, it does sound like a rather cool job being one of the helicopter pilots for either the police force or the ambulance, because that is a form of service which you're doing something every day, which is pretty cool.
Well, 100% on that front.
The police force use the same helicopter that we train on at Shawbury now, so that is a handy little
hour
conversion. Yeah,
Just
on that front, James, we just before lockdown last year in my last job, we did a trip up to Shawbury to have a look around at the place and had a go in the simulators and Watto. I don't know whether CAE do any of the sims up at Shawbury, but the it was flipping brilliant. Genuinely one of the best sims I've been in, and genuinely one of the hardest helicopters I've seen to fly. I was sat in there with my no names, but the rear admiral I was working for at the time, and he's thousands of hours on Sea King, and I got in, just about made it onto the back of the ship, really, really badly. And he went, right, I'll show you how to do it. Took off and immediately nosedived into the sea. It was perfect.
But we do got us. They are our sims. So I was hesitating. I was resisting, you know, doing the industry marketing pitch. But so I'll just say that they are our sims, and I'm glad to hear that sort of they're really good. You know, it'd also be fair to say there was one or two teething troubles to sort of get them into service and up to speed as well. But there are.
I was diving into the sea.
And when do you start, James? When's the? Have you got a long hold? Are you straight in?
No, 8th of November I start Shawbury. So just quite a small hold, really.
Where are you going to do that? Don't say at home.
So I'm off down to Middle Wallop to Army headquarters, so Army Air Corps headquarters down there.
Well, check this out. One of the boys on his course has got a hold in Belize.
Yeah, good work.
Hold in Belize.
He's really jealous of my hold.
I bet you he is. Flipping heck, that's a great hold to get, isn't it? Just pop out to Belize.
Well, Watto, so we brought you along for a reason. I mentioned it was 30 years since the Gulf War. And I tell you what, one of the best things that we did in the job where I worked for you was there were, I think, you know, some of the people that work with us didn't know your backstory in around the Gulf War. And I got Watto to come along. We did a force development event, you know, going and seeing various places around London with historic with history connections to Zeppelin raids, this sort of stuff. And actually, we finished the day with Waddo talking through his story, more of which in a second. Which, especially the people who didn't know this story, were left sort of jaw on the floor, not really expecting it, because it's not the sort of thing that Waddo talks about all the time, you know, wandering around the place. And it's fascinating to hear. So, Waddo, in terms of the Gulf War, how did you end up there? So you said you were on 27 Squadron. Was it quick flash to bang in terms of turning up into the operating area, or had you known for a long time you were going?
No, it was fairly quick, actually, Goddess. I was, the junior pilot, so the JP on the squadron. And actually, I was, on holiday in Florida. So my sister lives in Florida. And so living the high life in Florida, and just got a call from one of the execs sort of saying, you'll be watching the news, and of course I wasn't. And, you'll know Kuwait, is that a country? But we're off in a couple of weeks. So, when you get back, we'll be quick workout, get the kit and off you go. So I really wasn't expecting it at all. I mean, it was in the days. So the squadron had fairly recently just deployed to Red Flag, and I wasn't allowed to go and fly on Red Flag because I wasn't experiencing it. It was a bit of a shock, So, well, I know you haven't got 500 hours yet, Wally, but you're off to the Gulf. So that was it. And I mean, to be honest, God, as you know, you get obviously, it'd be wrong to say there wasn't, a degree of anxiousness or trepidation, but there was a sort of a great degree of sort of professional excitement, because it was like being picked for the first team, So, the young football player coming through, or rugby player, or whatever. So, there was a great, great sort of feeling that I was part of it. And, as the time came to deploy, obviously, you start thinking about things a little bit more seriously. But, it was great. So got back and got ready and deployed over there. And when I actually deployed, I was the youngest pilot. People often give me that label still, which is wrong, to be accurate. Simon Burgess actually was the youngest one, I think, when we were actually flying in the war itself, but I was the sort of youngest, one of the first ones to deploy. So that stage, it was excitement to be part of the team and be included.
So how old were you at the time?
So at the time I was 24. So I mean, I don't know how old you are, James. Obviously for me now at this age, you look about 12, but I guess you're older. Because
26.
You're in the army. Yeah. So I was, 24. Joined the Air Force aged 18 because all I ever wanted to do was fly aeroplanes, and didn't really think I had the chance or whatever. But somehow, I was a test case that managed to get through and whatever, and didn't get weeded out. Whatever.
You were the second one, actually. I was first.
Yeah. So ends up on a day at the airfield at Marham with the rest of the squadron bunch who were deploying. He's getting on a coach to drive to Bryce Norton to fly to Germany, pick up the jets in Germany, and then fly over to the Gulf.
Just on that, when you went to Germany, I seem to remember Nick Hurd saying something along the lines of, it wasn't one squadron. It was one squadron, but mixed up with lots of different pilots. They seemed to get. Did they get all the most experienced pilots into that one squadron, regardless of where you were from?
Yeah, so they were. I mean, obviously, the fact that I was there meant that they weren't the most experienced. But there was only, I think, a dozen pilots or a dozen crews from Marham that went. And yeah, the idea was a composite wing, but within that, there were the sort of squadron identities and stuff. So Nick was on 15 Squadron, whose squadron commander was John Broadbent. Mm. We were on 27 Squadron, and tragically, just in a few weeks just before we deployed, our own squadron commander was killed in a fatal accident over the North Sea. So we sort of deployed without our squadron commander, who at the time actually was going to sort of lead, to be the detachment commander as such. So we went and essentially were taken under the wing by the German squadron commanders out there, like John Broadbent or whatever. But there was always a little bit, you know, because they were a very formed unit. Obviously, squadrons have got very strong identities, and so we were there, sort of as a side. It'd be wrong to say that, but we, you know, we were still the Marren bunch in amongst, you know, what was then sort of quite a dominant Germany bunch.
Ah, interesting.
And what? When did you actually get there? Did you get there at the back end of in the sort of November time in 1990?
No, it was late August. So it was late August in 90 when we arrived, we went to Bahrain. So we set up in Bahrain, and although, you know, the war didn't actually start until January. I don't know whether you were involved, but the F3s had deployed forward. So the F3s were sort of holding a queue and stuff in air defence. There were F4s that were back in Cyprus in reserve, because
that was me when I was there bravely in reserve in Cyprus, which is a hell of a place to have a war.
in the animal house, yeah.
Exactly.
So when we hit the ground, I mean, we hit the ground running and we were holding quick reaction alert because we thought that all of the Iraqi troops, you know, there were however many, you know, tens of thousands, were going to continue their advance through Kuwait and into Saudi Arabia. And so our job was to just throw everything at them to stop them, sort of to stop that advance should it happen. Of course, they never did that. And then we went into a few months of build up and strategizing and various things like that. Not that I was involved in that, you know, But at the time we were on quick reaction alert and expecting to go sort of with the jets loaded up as full as they could. And
Nick Hurd said, maybe I remember this wrongly, but I think he said he deployed out there later and it was only a couple of weeks and then it kicked off. Is that how you remember it, Dave? Were you there with Nick?
Yeah, so I'm not sure exactly when Nick deployed, but. So we were there in August and there was a fairly small, I think we had something like 12 jets or something like that at the beginning. And then gradually, obviously, the op got bigger and bigger. So first of all, we were only in Bahrain. Then we set up the bases at Tobruk and Dhahran. So we brought in more and more squadrons, more and more people getting involved. So it just expanded and expanded. So I spent six weeks at Bahrain. And then the Marren team moved up to Tobruk and set Tobruk. So Tobruk is a base, you know, in sort of the not far away from Medina, actually, in Saudi Arabia, and a very sort of remote location. I mean, you know, the middle, you know, very culturally Arabic in terms of, you know, not really having that much exposure. It was a BAE Systems base, but not much exposure to all of these Air Force hordes, you know, coming in there to set that base up. So that was an amazing time, actually. But we did that, and then we came back home in November. So when they realised that this was going to be long term, there were many more crews and stuff, and they needed to turn the handle. So we came back in November, and along with lots of other crews who deployed there from the beginning, and didn't expect to go back out again. To be honest, you know, we thought sort of that was it was done. The rest of the crews had sort of taken over. So Nick may well have been one of those. Obviously, he went to Bahrain. But you know, it wasn't to be. Obviously, we sort of, you know, ended up going back there.
And did you go back before the start, or did you go in January, or did you go back after that?
Yeah, so we were back for a couple of weeks. And then, you know, we got the next message, which was, you're going to go back out there. And so we had Christmas at home and then went back there just after Christmas because we sort of knew at that stage, you know, when it was, broadly speaking, when it was going to start. So we went back out there at the beginning of January and went back to Bahrain. At this stage, the squadron had got a new squadron commander, a guy called Nigel Elston, who'd only just qualified on the Tornado. He was a Jaguar pilot, you know, for most of his career. So you know, we went back out there with our new squadron commander, and just literally a few days before the shooting started. So I think we had one or maximum of two sort of reef for mill sorties, because we've been there a long time, obviously. So, you know, well, one or two for mill sorties, and that was it. We were waiting for it, for the balloon to go up.
Now, were you all tasked in the tornado force with airfield denial, or were you on a range, or were you on a range of roles? Were you just operating the JP-233?
Yeah. So at the beginning, primarily, yeah. So I think there were some aircraft that were doing the reconnaissance task, and a different base. But primarily, our role was to keep the Iraqi Air Force on the ground. So by attacking their airfields, and the JP-233 was a monster of a weapon, but it was designed specifically for that task. So that was our primary role. In the beginning was to contribute by doing that.
What was your feelings then? So you knew the shooting war was going to start. So you just had Christmas at home, and then back out there. I guess there was a palpable excitement about the place, was there? Was there a trepidation as well?
Yeah, I think it was all of that mixed on, yeah. I mean, you get different stories, but I think, you know, there was a one level, obviously, at some point, you know, some element of fear because, you know, you knew you were going to be shot at and stuff. And, you know, we maybe didn't quite understand, you know, that stage by all of the capabilities that the Iraqis had and stuff. But we knew there was a risk. Countered against that was the fact that we, at that stage, we really expected the ground war to be very, very bloody indeed, you know, really hard fighting. So there was a point of, you know, dry your eyes, you know, this is going to be tough stuff, you know, so, you know, crack on with it. At a different level, there was that sort of, you know, professional excitement, but also the professional anxiety in terms of, well, actually, how am I going to do, you know, under that sort of pressure, which you can't train for. You know, you can try and get close to it, but you can't really train for that. So, you know, yeah, am I going to sort of stand up to this? Am I going to do it? And so that was a different level, you know, and then a sort of personal level, of course, of being separated from families and stuff. I mean, during the time that I came back home, I got engaged to Claire and stuff. So, you know, I was obviously sort of missing family back home and stuff, and not really knowing how long you were going to be away for. You know, when we go away to Goose Bay, you know, in those days, any Goose Bay or Red Flags or whatever, you know, it's sort of 2 or 3 weeks and you know your end date. But then, you know, there was no end date, which itself brought a different level. But a fantastic sense of, you know, collective endeavour and comradeship and stuff like that as well. You know, people, well, we're all individuals and people deal with it very individually in terms of how they cope with that sort of thing. You know, there's no right way or wrong way. People just do it their own way to get through it. But, you know, I think running through that, I think I would say, you know, a huge amount of professionalism by everyone involved.
And were you crewed up with the same guy that you were crewed up with previously? Did you rotate back as a crew?
Yeah, so I was crewed with Roy because I was, you know, the youngster when we sort of first deployed him. Poor old Robbie Stewart, you know, who was one of the most experienced navigators, you know, a professional aviator. You know, so Robbie's 20 years older than me, but so, you know, he got the youngster, and we were, you know, we had a fair bit of responsibility on our shoulders. You know, we were the sort of deputy lead of the eight ship and stuff, but anyway, yeah, so I was crewed up with Robbie before we deployed in the August, actually. You know, so we did a few workup sorties because I'd never done operational low flying. So, you know, because again, I wasn't experienced enough to do operational low flying. So I had to do a very quick workup on operational low flying up in Moon Country in Scotland and stuff in order to have that to deploy and stuff. So yeah, I was crewed up with Robbie, you know, as we deployed and then stayed obviously crewed with Robbie throughout. And as you know, went through that whole experience. And I know you know very well Kirsty, his daughter.
Yeah, and for those listening, Kirsty, who is in the Blades in 2XL X Red Arrows as well. So, you know, clearly the RAF blood runs thick and strong, or at least the aviation blood there. So talk to us about, were you day or night when it came to, you know, the first day and operations?
So we were night, and I think, and, you know, you'd have to check the history books or whatever, but I think I'm saying there was maybe only one or possibly even two date sources. And then, you know, of course, on one of those, the two Johns, John Peters and John Nicol, got shot down. And I think, you know, they will say that the reason they were at daytime was because of a bit of a timing cock-up and delays and things like that. So so nighttime was definitely, you know, the place where we wanted to be, to stack things more in our favour. And, of course, the Tornado, you know, was the night bomber, you know, of that era. There was no more capable aeroplane to do that sort of job. So, so you know, most of the stuff was planned at night. So, I flew at night.
And how was that first mission? You know, with the trepidation and all that sort of stuff, you know, when you actually saw it, Nick went through it the other week and just flipping amazing, seeing AAA over targets and, you know, everything that you guys saw.
Yeah, it was incredible. I mean, I think once we briefed and got ready and had something to eat and stuff, and you know, we were all bantering and stuff, but you could see that there was a level of whatever you would call it, trepidation, anxiety, you know, but just getting on with it and doing everything that you needed to do. So and once you get to the jets, you know, once you walk out, once you get into the cockpit, get your helmet on and stuff, actually all of that just melted away. You know, you just focused on doing what you wanted to do or what you needed to do. You know, and that's a bit like any other sort of big exercise sortie, you know, sort of like making sure you're ready to taxi on time or whatever, and you're not the buffoon that's late or doesn't get, you know, the radios up and running and stuff like that. So very, very much focused on the task at hand, and you know, and sort of getting airborne and, you know, pretty much straight up to the tanker to sort of refuel, you know, as we were going in. So our first target was Shaiba Airfield, which is not far, you know, beyond the Kuwaiti border actually. But so it was a fairly sort of short transit. We needed some fuel from a Victor tanker, you know, who are our colleagues from Marham, and then, you know, very quickly into it.
It was really interesting the way that you described. Just a few questions ago, you described that feeling of the excitement and going out there and just going out after Christmas. I've just been reading a book actually called No Empty Chairs, which is about World War One and the British Expeditionary Force going out to France and the squadrons as they grew out in France. But a lot of it is talking about the feelings of the pilot and what they experienced. And what you just said, interestingly, I really mirrored you know, that squadron camaraderie and all that sort of stuff mirrored what it said in the World War One book. And I think that squadron feeling has just pervaded throughout time, hasn't it? Throughout the Royal Air Force's time. So my next question was, the thing that it said in the book was, when the guys got out there, they were raring to go. They had that anxiety, of course, that you've just described, but they wanted to get out and get the bit between their teeth and get out and do it. Did you have that feeling as you went on that first night?
Yeah, I mean, I think when the inevitability that you know, this was not going to be solved in any other way, then of course, you know, the route through to the other end is to go do it. And I don't know about others, but I, you know, personally was hoping that there'd be a political settlement or whatever, although, you know, it was pretty much inevitable that was never going to happen. But you know, when the sort of message came through loud and clear that had all failed, and the deadline had been given, then you know, then it was a case of, like, you know, let's get on with it. You know, you're not going to avoid this. So and I think, you know, again, you point out, I think, something that's really important. There's a, you know, we operate as teams, whatever the size of that team is, whether it's a squadron or it's a troop or a platoon in the army or whatever it happens to be, or it's a ship in the Navy. You know, actually the thing that draws you together is whatever your collective team is. You know, so not something that's so big that you can't relate to, but something where, you know every single person. You know everyone to your left and to your right and whatever. And I think for me, you know, in that, the most powerful thing, you know, with any doubts or anything that you might have had, but the most powerful thing, it sounds a little bit trite, but it's absolutely true, is, you know, forget about all the politics and the greater good of mankind and all of that. the thing that you desperately don't want to do is let your mates down. You know, you absolutely want, you know, them to be, you know, to hold you in great esteem and you to hold them in great esteem and stuff. And that for me was, even actually, and I know we'll go on to speak about, you know, the time actually in captivity. But that for me was one of the biggest drivers of anything is you know, being one of the team. And, you know, we can look back in history to the history of the Air Force and, you know, a great privilege in, you know, in more recent times to meet some of the Second World War prisoners of war and whatever. And you know, even then you go through training or whatever and you're given all the ethos training and stuff and it sort of absorbs a little bit. But the thought of letting anybody down, you know, was a massive driver and was always a massive driver through the rest of my career as well, I have to say.
So on that, Waddo, you mentioned what we're going to get on to talk about here. How many missions did you actually do before you get to the big night, and how did the big night go?
Yeah, so it was a second mission, and yeah, so on the first mission, just to sort of, you know, finish off your original question, so, you know, about the AAA, so the first mission was you know, a real eye-opener. So as we coasted in, we were just met with a wall of AAA, and then in the tornado, you know, so you're flying on autopilot at night, and I just remember, you know, so I didn't let it navigate itself. I just used the heading bug and I was just sort of weaving left and right, you know, through the sort of traces that I could see and stuff to get to the target and then go through the target. Sadly, on that mission, there's then a sort of huge explosion just off in, you know, essentially in battle formation on us. And that was sadly the squadron commander, Nigel Allison, and his navigator, Max Collier. You know, sort of the explosion from their aeroplane, so they were killed in action on that particular mission. You know, we then just fly a little bit further. We see a missile launch at us, so, you know, we're avoiding that and stuff, and at the same time as our leader's avoiding it. So, you know, eventually when we go lights on, we're at the wrong side of each other, so we obviously crossed over each other during that maneuver as well. So God knows how close we were and stuff. So it was... You know, it was a tragic a sortie, obviously, because we lost our a squadron commander and Max Collier. It's a great colleague, but you know, it was also, you know, very eventful. It was, you know, incredibly sort of exciting from that perspective. You know,
was that a four ship or an eight ship?
Yeah, that was a four ship parkie for that one. And
we were one of the boys on that first raid. Wow.
Yeah, and we were dropping JP-233, so we had that sort of pleasure of flying directly over the airfield and stuff, you know, being shot at. And, yeah, so that was, you know, was, if you like, you know, almost literally a baptism of fire. And, you know, was quite incredible. The second sortie, you know, to answer your other question, because, you know, God, as I never answer the question you actually asked me. So
no, it's good, but I'm enjoying the way there, though.
So the second sortie was entirely different. So the second sortie, you know, strap into the jets, we get going. Interestingly enough, I had a problem with, there was no spare aircraft, and I had a problem with the aircraft in the attention getters wouldn't go out. You know, I'm pressing constantly, and they wouldn't go out. And eventually, you know, I say to the ground crew, is there anything else I can do? And they say, well, no, sir, actually, you're going to have to crew out. The only thing you could do is to take the bulbs out. So, you know, I had a quick conversation with Robbie or whatever, and said, okay, we'll take the bulbs out, you know, because we've still got the central warning panel and stuff. So we took the bulbs out of the attention getters and cracked on. So that was the start of it. But other than that, it was completely uneventful, up to the tanker. For once in my life, I get into the tanker first time, you know, no problem at all, and descend off the tanker into low level. Absolutely quiet, just like a, you know, a training sortie, basically. No sign of any enemy activity whatsoever. And as we accelerate, I have to say, I sort of remember this through, you know, the cockpit voice recorder and things like this, because actually, you know, after ejecting, I lost my memory for about 2 minutes or so, you know, up to, I can remember exactly the shoot down bit, but my situational awareness, you know, I was about 25 miles out in terms of where I thought we were geographically. But anyway, so, you know, as we come to the airfield, come to the target, we accelerate up. So, you know, we're doing 540 knots, getting ready for a loft attack. Because in this case, having gone through the first sortie with all of the AAA, we were trying to do some suppression using 1,000-pounders before the back four, because we're now an eight ship, before the back four go through using JP233. And, of course, they've got to fly over the effort. So the front four of us were lofting 1,000-pounders in, trying to keep heads down and stuff for the back four to go through. So we're just on the point of sort of pulling up. And so the first real event of notable event of the sortie is just seeing this effing great rocket sort of fired at me sort of from directly ahead. You know, and then the RHWR, so the radar homing and warning receiver, just starts going mad with all the alarms and stuff. And and obviously, you know, as you know, we now have a Roland sort of coming towards us doing Mach 3 or whatever a Roland does, and you know, we're doing 540 knots towards it in a 28 ton tornado that doesn't, you know, at night with no NVGs and you know, that doesn't turn particularly beautifully. So unlike your great typhoons that you get to fly now. So that's the situation we see ourselves in at that point.
Wow. What sort of missile is the Roland?
So Jamie, the Roland is a French missile and a very clever French missile, which made it sort of difficult for us to detect and stuff when they were going through their sort of processes leading up to fire. So that's why we had such a late warning on it. But it's a short range radar guided missile. So that was used. So the Iraqis had to protect their bases, basically, which is sort of what it was doing. You know, so I can't really beef about what it was doing. That's what it was there for.
And can you see this thing coming up at you?
Yeah, so you can see, as I say, you can see it fired. So because the engine burns, you know, a very short burn.
Yeah,
I can't remember how long it is, but you know, no longer than a second or whatever to accelerate. So you can see that very, very bright in the night sky, and then of course it, you know, that burns out. So you've no idea where it is. Oh. But you can hear your warning sort of receiver sort of, you know, keep bleating at you that it's coming inbound.
And do you remember it? Well, I mean, I was going to say, did it hit the aircraft? It might not have hit the aircraft. Actually, do you remember the concussion of the hit?
Yeah. So so you're right. Yeah, it didn't hit the aircraft. So yeah, again, at that stage, the only thing I can do is take manual control. So I'm now flying a tornado. I'm trying to do a break to the left, but got to imagine this is, you know, this it takes about 3 or 4 seconds, about 4 seconds, I think, from the missile firing to actually the explosion near the aeroplane. Because your question's bang on, actually. It didn't hit. It just exploded very close to the aeroplane. So I'm trying to, you know, fly the aircraft to the left, but also as worried about flying into the ground, you know, which I'm definitely going to be killed, as making sure, as you know, I do what I can to avoid this missile. And I just remember there's sort of a massive flash. And it just felt for me that I was pinned back in the seat, almost like, wow. You know, I had a sort of, you know, huge gush of wind that was pinning me back in the seat. And sure enough, it exploded so close that it hit the underside of the aeroplane, shattered the canopy. So, you know, essentially, you know, one of my sayings is, you know, it's now flying a 600-mile-an-hour cabriolet, you know, and just I just my last waking thought, I just remember trying to get my arms down towards the ejection handle and just not being able to move and then losing consciousness. Yeah, and that was it. So, you know, at that moment in time, you know, I absolutely was 100% sure that I was going to die. And, you know, that was it, because I was just pinned, couldn't move at all.
So sorry to sound stupid, you did eject?
Did, because in the back seat, Robbie, who I mentioned earlier, so in a tornado, he's protected a little bit by all the computer screens and stuff.
Yeah.
And so he's still conscious. He realizes very quickly. So he had a so there's a fire in the aeroplane where it had hit the hydraulics, and so he recalls there being a fire around his feet.
Oh my word!
And very quickly, sort of knowing that something's happened to me, and so he pulls his ejection handle, and because the command eject system, that ejects me out the front. So You know, but I, you know, lots of people ask me about what's it like to eject. I haven't got a clue. You know, I was unconscious before it ever started. I was unconscious through it, and probably was unconscious for about 20 minutes on the grind as well.
Oh my word!
So yeah, but you know that fact saved my life.
At least the attention getters didn't go off.
I wouldn't have been able to compute that, Parky, because that would have just been one more flash in a bunch of flashes. But
that sensation, Dave, of you sort of passing out, that feels like yesterday, I imagine. I bet that's kind of still with you.
Yeah, so I mean, it's really interesting. So I did a, through the years, obviously, you know, given lectures and stuff, and I reckon that I've probably been asked every question that you could possibly be asked. But I did a charity thing at the Petwood, actually, at Woodhall Spa, for the Lincolnshire Bomber Command Memorial. And I spoke with Charles Clark. I mean, you know, I was Charles Clark. Charles Clark, for people who don't know, is a Second World War prisoner of war. He's sadly passed away now, but he was the chairman of the Bomber Command Memorial Association and Bomber Command Association eventually, and then but also the chair of the Royal Air Force Ex-Prisoner of War Association. So essentially, you know, I was Charles's warm-up act as he gave his story about Stalag Luft 3 and stuff. So, but a lady asked me a question there that I'd never been asked before. And it was interesting because you're saying that, you know, when I tell the story, is it like I'm actually telling a story now? Or does it take me back there? And actually, to be honest, when I do that, the only thing that takes me back there is actually the bit about the interrogations and this bit about, you know, the actual bit of being shot down and stuff. And it's where, you know, whatever, I can't help but sort of go back to that moment.
Exactly, yeah.
And Dave, there is something I do have to ask you, because, you know, those of us who know you, there's a little bit around the sort of the eyes where, you know, you've got some, you know, a little bit of tattooing there. Just talk a little bit through what that is the legacy of.
Yeah, so I mean, JB asked the question about you know, whether the missile hit or missed, and the fact that it missed, but obviously it's, I can't remember the role now. I think it's not exploding rods, it has little tiny pellets.
It's like bow ties, aren't they?
so this stuff as it exploded, and obviously the canopy was shattered, and I'm in a left-hand turn, so trying to, you know, I think all right-handed pilots, you know, without thinking, will instinctively brake to the left. So, you know, I was sort of trying to brake to the left. So on this side of my face, the left side of my face, I have quite clean scars, because that's just where bits of chunk of visor and canopy sort of went into my face. And on the right-hand side, they're black. And they're black because they're tiny bits of Roland fragmentation, which, of course, you know, don't get cleaned for 6 weeks, you know, 7 weeks until I get to Cyprus eventually afterwards. And so they caused a tattoo. They're called carbon tattoos. So tiny fragments. And I even have a tiny fragment in my right eye.
Oh, my word.
So which went through, but it doesn't affect my vision. You know, I can't see it. But, you know, of course, if I tell this story to any optician or whatever, I, you know, make sure I get the eye drops doubled and whatever as they try and search it. And they take great delight in telling me that it's still there. So, yeah, I knew it's still there. I realised it hasn't come out, but now I can't see for a week. But yeah, so the black stuff is the carbon tattooing. And I mean, it's faded now, but quite often, just afterwards, you know, I'd be doing something and people very politely come up to me and say, you know, Waddo or Dave or whatever, you know, do you know you've got pen all over your eye?
Actually Roland missile.
Yeah.
It's a very long story, but it's not pen. It won't rub off.
Can I ask, this is a, I don't know, I think it is relevant. I don't know why it occurred to me, but how many thousand pounders were you carrying? Because I think all of us that have flown aeroplanes know that is a significant disadvantage to manoeuvring the aeroplane. And so how many were you carrying to loft on in there?
So we were carrying five, Dunk. You know, I mean, there was a massive QI esoteric device. I wasn't a QI at the time. I became one later, so I can whinge about them at this point. But they, there was a massive esoteric debate about whether 8 was better than 5, but 5 was heavy enough and gave you a bit of an advantage. So we were carrying 5.
Because I guess you didn't have time to punch them off. You just tried to break.
No, I mean, it literally was. It was a case of seeing the missile, shouting to Robbie that there was a missile launch. You know, we knew we couldn't flare at night time because that would give our sort of, you know, visual, our position away. So, you know, just shouted at him to throw some chaff. And then, you know, as it turned in the aeroplane, literally, you know, 4 seconds later, it's bang. So, no chance to sort of react in that way.
Well, I guess you had the wings back as well, didn't you? You'd have had the wings back, wouldn't you?
So the wings were in 45 at that stage, yeah. So 67 was air show only.
Okay.
And, but yeah, and I can't remember whether we were flying big tanks or little tanks because that affected the wing sweep as well. But they were in 45. That was, you know.
So effectively, you'd have put, you know, 90 degrees of bank on and pulled, but kept going in the same direction.
Well, not even that aggressively done, because I say it was, you know, we're going from TFR, and I say these days, you know, it's difficult to think, but you know, we had no EO sensors or NVG or whatever; it's just inky black. So, you know, taking it out, trying to look at the little e-scape with the terrain following radar to sort of at least get some measure that the ground is relatively flat, and just rolling the aircraft and starting to pull. So, you know, we're really only through, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 degrees or so of turn before it hits.
When people go through something like this, they often look back at it and think, goodness me, if only I'd have done X, Y, Z. Do you look back at this and think there's absolutely nothing we could have done? And unless you know they're going to fire that missile, once that missile's in the air, there's nothing you could have done other than what you did? Or do you think back about it and think, yeah, actually, we could have come up with something?
Well, it's sort of it's another really important point afterwards, because we were fortunate to get the accident data recorder back.
Oh wow!
It was really important to understand what we did, or for me anyway. Going back to what I said at the beginning, in terms of not letting your mates down and stuff, and you know, and clearly being responsible or potentially responsible for something that, you know, Robbie goes through with me as well. But just to sort of looking and understanding, so what were the tactics of the time and what we were supposed to do, and did I do that? And in essence, you know, the answer was yes. I mean, there's other stories about people, you know, being fired at by a missile and barrel rolling it around it at night, you know, and recovering at 20 feet and stuff. And I sort of reconcile myself to that in terms of, well, that's just luck. You know, there are many really good aviators lost their lives because, you know, they lost an argument with the ground, and you know, you're sort of playing probabilities there. So did I do what the tactic said to do, which is in essence at the time were a 2G break against a Roland. So, well, yes, you know, that's what we were sort of going towards. And again, there was stuff with the electronic warfare kit and RHWR and whatever, which meant that we didn't realize it at the time, but it didn't quite perform as we thought it would perform against the Roland missile system. But it was really important to me to sort of understand basically that I hadn't, you know, screwed up. And I think if I'd have believed that, I wouldn't have gone back to flying fast jets. And certainly I wouldn't, God is the one to judge or whatever, but I wouldn't have felt that I had the legitimacy to then sort of move through the command structure and lead others. And again, it sounds a big sort of statement, but you know, it was important to me.
Yeah, so it's very interesting to say, you know, the tactic there was a 2G break against a Roland. I wouldn't even know how you'd know it was a Roland.
Yeah, well, so once it starts alarming, it gives you an identification. So, and clearly now in the past, you know, we know it was a Roland.
Yeah,
but actually, also the intelligence in terms of the airfield, we knew that there'd been an active Roland there a couple of days before we flew. So we knew that there was a fairly reasonable chance. Of course, we hoped it had been taken out, but we knew that there was a fairly reasonable chance that there was an active Roland still on that airfield.
So,
it was no surprise that it was a Roland and not something else.
So, Dave, you're asleep. What does Robbie remember of the next bit? Is he, you know, when he comes down on a shoot, is he frantically looking for you? You know, what's happening? Is he seeing World War III going on around him?
Yeah, so Robbie, you know, and obviously he's the best one to tell his story, but Robbie, you know, as he ejects, he's his leg is hit by the personal survival pack, the PSP, and it smashes his leg. So it breaks his leg in three places. So he's on the ground now, drifting in and out of consciousness because of the pain in his leg. I mean, you know, the bones are out of the skin, you know, so he's in a bad way. And so Robbie, so we never get together. So I wake up and I see some footprints nearby, and Robbie was the sort of survival expert of the squadron, you know, so I think, you know, Robbie's, and clearly, obviously, I suspect that he must have ejected us. So I'm thinking Robbie's in a better state, and he's come by, he's seen me and stuff. I'm unconscious. He can't do anything for me. And therefore he started his evasion. But in reality, he was in and out of consciousness all night, and with his leg badly broken, he's completely immobile. So he's, you know, he's stuck on the ground and gets picked up the next day.
And what about you? You know, when you wake up, is it still dark? You know, are you seeing explosions behind you? You know, what's going on?
So you've got to realize now. So my mental picture is I 20 miles away from the, you know, from the base that we were attacking and stuff. But I see AAA sort of coming up from the base in the distance and can't really quite compute why it feels so close. But I start my evasion. I mean, I'm completely, you know, you can imagine, you know, you've jumped out of an aeroplane at 600 miles an hour. You know, you think you were dead before that even happened. So you're sort of wondering, well, hang on a minute, what's happening to me now? You know, why am I here? And my radios are all bust. You know, so my PLB is sort of bust. You know, the wires are hanging out. Or every sort of sachet of water that I'd stuffed around my pockets has been blown off by the ejection. So I have one sachet of water in my knee pad. That's the only thing that sort of survived and stuff. And both my arms are really badly dislocated. So I managed to get this shoulder, my right shoulder, back into position. So that's got a bit of mobility. But my left elbow is so badly dislocated that I can't get the LSJ off my arm, yeah, because it's like stretched the arm bit tight. I can't get it over. So I'm a bit sort of screwed, you know. So I have to let go the parachute, and I have to let go my PSP and stuff just to get away. And I just start evading into the night, but you know, absolutely, you know, really sort of in quite sort of deep shock, really. Try on my PLB to sort of make some radio calls and stuff, but you know, I mean, no, nothing was ever received, nothing was ever heard. So that sort of was bust. It looked bust, but it was bust. And so evade through the night, basically, until sort of the you know, you can see light coming into the day, and realize that, you know, I've got to try and find somewhere to hide out and stuff. So there's a couple of pipelines that run to the west of Talil. So we're attacking the airbase at Talil, and so try and make a sort of a shallow grave between these two pipelines or whatever to try and hide out. I mean, to be honest, looking back, the best thing to do would probably have been to stay still, you know, because then you wouldn't leave a trace and stuff like that. And obviously, you're in a sort of wide expanse of desert and stuff, and it probably would have been more difficult to find. But obviously, you know, sort of, that's not what you're taught, and you're not thinking that sort of quickly at that stage. So yeah, and then sort of as the next day breaks and comes up, you know, a few hours later, I'm obviously fined by the Iraqis, and they take me into captivity.
I mean, stupid question, but do you have a sense of how much trouble you're in at that point?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So you know this isn't going to be pleasant. You've almost conditioned yourself. You know, we had these cards, and the cards were, you know, commonly known as ghoulie chits, and these were sort of cards to present over, because we carry some gold coins to try and, you know, to try and bribe or whatever, you know, people to help if you're in that situation. But we had these chits, you know, that said, you know, if you help this airman or whatever, you'll be generously rewarded and blah blah blah. but they were commonly known as Gulichits because, you know, in the Second World War, for obvious reasons, people, you know, with these cards or whatever, but, you know, various parts of their anatomy had, you know, not survived, you know, and this was the sort of colloquial story stuff. So you'd almost condition yourself that this was going to be horrendous. But the only thing, you know, but the only thing that I always say is actually when you're sort of faced with that situation, well, you know, the only alternative is not to be there at all.
Yeah.
So, you know, you just almost got to take it minute by minute in terms of, you know, if you can survive the next 5 minutes, 10 minutes, one day, one week or whatever, then, you know, there is a chance of coming out the other end of this.
So if you...
How hostile were those guards that captured you, those soldiers?
So there was two of them initially, Parky, and they came towards me, and because of my arms, I hadn't even been able to. So we flew with the pistols that didn't have a magazine in them at the time. I mean, it sounds a bit ridiculous these days, but we didn't have the sort of magazines in them because the idea was you put the magazine and then you didn't have the sort of a risk of an ND in the cockpit or anything like that. But I wasn't able to do that because of my arms. Because it was, you know, the pistol was tucked under a holster under my arm, so they came towards me, and there was an older guy and a younger guy, and the younger guy was, you know, was a bit energetic. The younger guy was, you know, a bit emotional. The older guy was actually quite calm. So sort of the younger guy came. I mean, first of all, they fired close to me as sort of warning shots, and then they were gesticulating to put my arms above my head, which I couldn't do. Yeah, because you know, not that I was trying to be belligerent, but I just couldn't do it. And
imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
So that sort of caused a bit of angst. And then the younger guy sort of came up eventually and... you know, he gave me, you know, a bit of a lashing and whatever, but then was calmed down by the older guy, and then, you know, then I was taken to where another group of them were and stuff. So yeah, but again, you know, I was keen to put this into perspective, and you know, I mean, it wasn't pleasant, it wasn't nice, but you look at some of the other stories, even in that stage, you know, what happened to some of the U.S. prisoners of war and stuff, and. You know, people that initial capture was pretty horrendous for some. So whereas for me, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a pleasant Sunday afternoon stroll or whatever. But I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't say it was horrendous. It was sort of, you know, about what I expected, really.
And the people that captured you, did anything strike you about them in terms of like their did they seem like a disciplined bunch? They seem like an organized unit. How did they come across?
So semi-disciplined, you know, they were obviously, they were dressed sort of in half military clothes and half civil clothes. And, you know, so they're obviously sort of part of the organization, you know, but you know, they weren't, you know, ruthlessly military or disciplined or even, you know, particularly had a plan, really. I think it was all a bit of a shock to them as well. So, you know, I was taken, there was about, eventually about seven of them. and they did a search of me and stuff, and you know, took my gold coins. I always wondered actually what you were supposed to do with gold coins, because take them. They're not going to say, hang on a minute, no, you can't have them all now. You can just have one now. The rest take me to the other side of the border. But anyway, I never quite sussed that one out. But my gold coins went, and very quickly. Difficult to say.
What about your medical care? Did they look after you?
Sorry?
What about your medical care? Did they look after you?
No, at that stage they were just more interested in finding out what they could. I mean, they weren't asking me questions at that stage. They were just searching me, and then getting me sort of handed over to the sort of proper authorities, really, which came next. But
who were they, Dave? Who was it? A group of soldiers that were actively looking for you?
I think they were more from the airbase, Doug. So I think they were, you know, if you like, almost. I don't know, whatever they're sort of, you know, I wouldn't describe them as the equivalent of the regiment or whatever, but they were just people who were from the airbase, or probably base security or something like that. But I don't think they were army per se,
right?
But somehow linked to the airfield itself.
I'm sure you would wish never to see these people ever again. But would you like to ask them any questions about that day?
Well, I don't think, I mean, those people, honestly, Jay, for most of the Iraqis, you know, I would, even though they were being unpleasant or whatever, I think the only ones that I, you know, that I have a real problem with are the ones that were inhumane for inhumane's sake. So, you know, these guys, you've got to think of in terms of, well, what if they'd done something different, you know? What if they treated me really nicely? What effect would that have had on them? You know, just wouldn't be feasible or credible for them to act in that way. So I really don't hold anything against them, or indeed anything against, you know, the sort of Roland operators or whatever. They were doing what they were expected to do, and probably had they not, you know, they would have met a fairly unpleasant fate. So the only ones through the whole experience that I would have a real angst about are actually much later in sort of Baghdad and the Ba'ath Party. And the ones just with me, but with other people, were just in a sort of a position of ultimate authority and actually sort of enjoyed just abusing that for the sake of it. So they're the ones that I would have a real, you know, real issue with. But for those, you know, who picked me up there and stuff, I mean, I'd love to ask them about what they were thinking and, you know, what their plans were, what they'd been asked to do and stuff, what they felt about the whole war and what was happening to their airfield and stuff. But
you know, what were you thinking at the time?
You know, I think that was sort of, you know, almost expected.
What were you thinking at the time? What, were you relieved because you only had one pack of water? I mean, was it? I mean, survival out there. I guess it's difficult for me to imagine exactly where you were, but I guess just in the desert there, surviving through the day would have been emotional.
Yeah, I just felt that, you know, I mean, obviously being in captivity now sort of, you know, drew down one potential avenue of rescue, which, you know, even though I couldn't make sort of contact, I was sort of hoping that somehow, you know, people would be sort of tracking and understand, and maybe, you know, a rescue mission or something that, you know, could come in and stuff. But so that closed down any sort of avenue of escape. And then it was really sort of focus on, you know, what's going to happen to me next, and am I going to be able to survive it, or indeed am I going to be allowed to survive it? So that was, you know, the overwhelming fear then of what comes next.
And where did you get taken? So once you captured, did they put you in a vehicle and take you back off somewhere else?
They put me in a vehicle, and eventually I ended up in the town of Al Nazira into a sort of a military compound who I think was the Republican Guard, because, you know, I was then blindfolded, but you know, you could glimpse stuff out of the blindfold, and you know, I think they were wearing very distinctive sort of, you know, ready orange berets and stuff. And I mean, the atmosphere, you know, was like a lynch mob. You know, there's lots of people. I could tell there were lots of people around the Land Rover, whatever it was, that the Jeep, that as it was pulled out of this, and you know, absolutely sort of wondered what on earth was going to happen next. And I was, you know, pretty unceremoniously sort of dragged into a room or whatever, and which I guess was some sort of one of their senior leaders. And they, you know, they spoke to each other in Arabic, so I had no idea what they said. And but then surprisingly, I was put back into the vehicle and driven away to the local hospital in Italy. So, you know, that was a bit disorientating because you just didn't know what was going to happen. But driven into the local hospital, and I mean, I, you know, it's a long, long story to do the sort of full story, but you know, pick the bits out of it. But at the hospital, so I was handed over to the medics, and they, you know, I had bunches, you know, chunks of stuff in my face and whatever. Both my arms were badly desiccated, as I mentioned, and stuff. And I was on a table, and they were picking stuff, you know, just pulling stuff out of my face, and also then one of the guys, so they asked one of the guards about you know, painkillers and stuff, and he sort of refused me to have any painkillers or anything. So sort of picking this stuff out, it was bloody painful, and then they relocated my elbow, but they literally just got the knee up against the elbow and levered it back into place. So, you know, which was a little bit painful. And at that point, you know, I sort of
screamed, just a little bit.
Yeah, I just screamed out a bit or whatever, you know. And I remember this Iraqi just sort of leaned over. He said to me, "Be a man." So okay, well, sorry, but yeah. And then from there, I was sort of, you know, taken back to the airbase, taken back to Al Talil, and the first interrogation, which was with the aircrew. Which was, you know, I mean, if we've got time, you know, it's an interesting, because this is about, you know, pilot episodes and stuff. So now there was a real case of a, you know, I was going to call it a fraternity. That'd be the wrong word these days, wouldn't it? But you know, a sort of a collective spirit, because, you know, I was taken into this sort of room with the aircrew, and the first thing they said to me, so they sort of lifted up the blindfold, and the first thing they said to me was, "We're not going to hurt you," and then they sort of, you know, I didn't like do introductions, but they said, "Oh, look, Mr. David, you know, this guy here, he was a prisoner of war in the Iran war. You know, we know what you're going through, blah blah blah. We're going to ask you some questions, but we're not going to hurt you," and so they started asking me the sort of questions, and obviously name, rank, number, date of birth, and then, you know, I can't answer that question. And there was never any sense of, you know, any sort of threat of violence or anything there. And then eventually I was taken to who I assume was their base commander's office. And again, you know, they gave me some food, you know, a really nicely set out plate of food and stuff. And, you know, he asked me some questions and stuff, and I can't answer those questions. Said, "Mr. David, if you answer the questions, we'll look after you here. If you don't answer the questions, I'm going to have to send you to Baghdad, and there they will make you answer the questions." And it comes back to one of the points about, you know, saying before about not letting the team down and stuff like that. Oh. It was incredibly tempting to sort of take him up at his word, but I just knew it was the wrong thing to do. And also I knew that it was an empty promise as well, but it was just the wrong thing to do.
I can't
answer your questions. And he just said, "Well,
like, what were the questions? You go to Baghdad."
Sorry, JB.
What were the questions?
So it's name, rank, number, date of birth, which are questions that we can answer. And yeah, then it was, you know, what aircraft do you fly? That was always the first question.
Ah.
That question. So that was it. So I put in another vehicle and driven however many hours up to Baghdad.
So I guess this is a broader question, not necessarily just for you, but I mean, it's obvious what aircraft you fly because it's on the ground somewhere. I mean, why couldn't you answer that?
Because it's essentially the start then of a dialogue, JB, I think is the argument behind it. And once you go through that, where do you stop? But it does become very important sort of later in the story. But it is, you know, once you've broken that threshold, and it was a very big moment, because eventually I did, but once you've broken that threshold, it's another sort of gate that you've gone through,
yeah, and
which you know you're not supposed to. You know, we had our policy and stuff, and you know, I won't go into details of stuff or I, you know, the policy and has, how it's changed, because I guess that's still pretty sensitive, Goddess. But you know, it was one of those things that, you know, what you do in the captivity is name, rank, date of birth, and you give no further information. So how long can you stick with that? So it's a sort of big question.
What's a realistic amount of time that the RAF expect you to stick with that? Because it can't be forever.
Well, I say we're straying now into sort of slightly sensitive areas. So I won't talk about what the current expectations or policy is. But at the time, it was a straight sort of black and white, you know, nothing further. So you know, somewhat unrealistically, obviously. But that was what the policy was. So,
and so when you arrived in Baghdad, did you get moved around, or did you get immediately taken to the place that you would spend a little bit of time?
No, so you immediately go to the interrogation centre, which I don't know where it was, but on the way, going back to, you know, this whole experience and giving it balance. So on the way, at the hospital, they put a plaster cast onto my arm after they sort of relocated my elbow, and it was too tight on my arm, it was cutting off the blood supply, becoming really painful. So they stopped at a little medical facility, you know, I don't know, an hour outside of Baghdad or something, and this place was run by a woman, you know, she was in charge and stuff, and she sort of relieved the pressure on my arm, but unbeknownst to sort of me at the time, I didn't realize what she was doing, but also unseen by the Iraqi captors, she put a load of painkillers into my pocket, and she whispered into my ear, for when you need them, and because she knew what was going to happen to me.
Oh, God.
And this was, you know, it was a tremendously courageous bit of humanity, I think, in terms of that whole experience and stuff. And you know, I think it's important, you know, that I'm sure we're not naive enough, but it's important not to colour all Iraqis by what, you know, one or two sort of bad ones did. So I mean, it was just phenomenal, and
that's amazing. That, you know, given that she can't have been expecting you, I guess.
No. So just just incredible, you know. And
wow. Have you managed to find her?
No idea. And it actually, for a while, it was sort of, you know, I didn't really want to speak about it because I didn't want to put her at risk, you know, whilst the sort of regime was still in place and stuff.
Yeah.
But anyway, so. So I arrived at the interrogation centre, and, you know, it was pretty much sort of straight into the interrogations or whatever, blindfolded, name, rank, number, date of birth, you know, what aircraft do you fly? I cannot answer that question. And then, you know, the beating started. So, you know, not to labour the sort of beatings bit, but yeah, you're then faced with, so this is now a shock, you know, you're now a Westerner. In all of the comforts of the Western world and stuff, and you know being beaten up by some brutes who are doing it because they're supposed to be doing it, you know, that's their job, and you know, sort of thinking, how long can I take this? You know, this is now completely disorientating. People are really hurting me, and the beatings. I mean, you're probably too young, but Barkin and I will remember. You know, the sort of the old Cold War stuff of. You know, you sort of the beatings starting, but then, you know, gradually ramping up and getting a bit more severe. There was none of that. It was absolutely full on until I was unconscious. And then they sort of bring me back round again. Name, rank, number, date of birth. What aircraft do you fly? I cannot answer that question. And then just starting again. So, you know, but the interrogations, you know, from pilot stories and stuff, the interrogations... Yeah, you know, we sort of spoken about it in lectures and things like that. And I think it's sort of fairly well documented. So I think the important thing there is, for me anyway, is, you know, what's going through your mind, and again, it's this point of, right, okay, I'm pretty sure that I'm not going to survive this forever. I'm pretty sure I'm not strong enough to go to my grave and not tell, because I'm not going to tell them that I flew the tornado. But how long can I last? You know, how long is good enough? You know, how long can I carry on for and stuff until, you know, to make sure, again, I'm, you know, not letting down the team or whatever. And of course, in a cold light day or whatever, no one can blame anybody for doing anything. But it's still that sort of driver.
So, again, I'm sorry for the parade of ridiculous questions, but when I think of physical, a physical beating and why it is so scary, it's because of the unknown amount of damage it's going to do. That's sort of that's the great unknown. You don't know how hurt or how badly damaged that you'll get. But at this point, you've got dislocated elbows, dislocated shoulders. You've already been beaten unconscious once. Presumably, you've got other great, other traumas. Are the beatings in any way getting any easier? Are you getting tougher or more resilient to it?
I don't know whether tougher or resilient. I think you know, there was a realization that essentially, the sooner I went unconscious, the better.
Yeah.
Because that was sort of the end of that particular episode. So certainly, you know, welcoming it rather than fighting it. I think instead of beyond at that stage worrying about, you know, permanent damage or stuff like that, just sort of, you know, trying to survive it, really. And you know, point out sort of, you know, so I had a cast on my arm, but that didn't stop them, you know, whacking my arm and stuff. But, you know, of course, that wasn't particularly painful because I had the cast protecting it, you know. So, and the reason I raise that is because it was, you know, not systematic. You know, we all think of these torturers with the pliers and stuff like that, and very scientific and precise or whatever. Ultimately, this was just a bit of a frenzied beating by, you know, by some Ba'ath Party henchmen, basically. So, you know, it wasn't the sort of scientific type interrogations that you might have expected, or the sort of tortures or whatever that you see in movies. You know, this was just, right, okay, you're not answering this question. We're not going to lay into you in any way that we can think of for the next few minutes. And
was there a sort of gap, Dave, and was there any time you were sort of back in your cell that you could use those painkillers?
Yeah, so the painkillers part, I mean, it's a really, really important part of this story is, so the interrogations eventually stopped for a break, and I find myself in this corridor, and I come to, and I'm lying on some other pilot's boots. I don't know who it was to this day, but I know they were American because, of course, you know, we used to cherish the American flying boots and flying kit and whatever. And I was just coming to lying on this pair of boots and stuff, and I'm feeling a bit sorry for myself, and remembered a few painkillers and stuff, you know, to take the worst of it off. And then after a certain time, I sort of get dragged in for another interrogation. So the painkillers helps. But, you know, more than that, actually, what the real significance of the painkillers is ultimately, you know, eventually sort of through these beatings and they at one point, so they lift up my blindfold. So at one point they tell me that, you know, they've got the two Johns and stuff, and they'll bring the two Johns in because, you know, they've already got their answers. So why am I not answering them and stuff, you know? And so go through that bit and sort of refuse, can't answer that question. They eventually sort of lift up my blindfold. And underneath me, obviously from the original search and stuff, one thing that has survived is my flight reference cards. And my flight reference cards have Flight Lieutenant DJ Waddington, Tornado GR1. And they're now presenting those in front of me, you know, having just taken a beating, and then sort of name, rank, number, date of birth, what aircraft do you fly? You know, it's like Tornado GR1. You know, at that point it was like,
yeah,
you know, what's the point? Okay, you've got me, checkmate. And that was a really, really difficult moment, but also the almost the start of the recovery, because it was difficult because, you know, you've got to imagine, you're going back to the beginning, you know, I'm the youngest guy that, you know, gone out there or whatever, but I find myself dumped on the desert floor in mission number two and stuff, you know, and I'm going through this sort of stuff. I'm trying to resist interrogation, and now I'm not resisting interrogation, you know, they've beaten it out of me, and I've just answered their question. So for me, that was the lowest point. But almost immediately, the two things happen. One is that you've got to quickly decide, actually. So, okay, if I'm not going to die because by protecting the information that I fly Tornado GR1, what am I prepared to die for? What if they ask me something that I really can't answer? And one of the things, and I won't go through the others, because again, you know, I don't want to give any future interrogator any hints or tips or whatever. But one of the things was, what if they ask me about painkillers? You know, what if they find them and they ask me where did I get them? What am I going to say? And so at that moment, so, you know, along with, you know, a few other things, I resolved that I will never tell them where I got these painkillers, even if I'm alive because of it, because I could never live with myself if something happened to that person, because I haven't been strong enough to resist that. Hopefully, fortunately, it never happens. But it is. Yeah, it makes you decide. And the other thing is, like, okay, so, you know, get a grip. How are you going to fight back? And again, I don't want to go into sort of too many details, but that's where, you know, that's where essentially we play strategy, we play tactics. You know, what am I going to tell them? What am I going to tell them, but not tell them everything? What am I going to tell them that's you know, downright untruthful to try and mislead them? And so that's the game we play. And on one time, I get caught out doing that, and you know, they teach me a lesson not to do that again. But I know there's something stupid about, you know, how much fuel the tornado carries or something like that, which they knew the answer to and knew I was completely bullshitting. But yeah, so they, you know, they make an example of that particular case. And then it's, you know, they sort of somehow have got through their list of questions, not particularly insightful or whatever, and that's it.
That's sort of my next question, which was, what do you think they were trying to get out of you? Like, what do you think they'd have been happy with to go back to their commander with?
I honestly think that they had a list of questions, and you know, I didn't think they had a sort of a bigger picture or the ability to vary the questions to try and find out, you know, things that might have been more useful to them. You know, I think they had, you know, question 1 for 20 or whatever it was, and then when they got to the bottom of the list, at, you know, that level, they were happy they'd done their job. There was any sort of particular sort of grand strategy that sat behind it. I don't think so. I think they were just, you know, asking fairly obvious questions, really.
And
feel that they were trying to find out something that would strategically help them in what was coming or to come?
I don't think at that stage, at that level, with the people who were, you know, doing the interrogations, they knew enough to know what to ask. You know, so, and again, it sort of comes back to the games being played. But, you know, one of the things, you know, I don't really want to sort of go into much detail, but, you know, going back to being, you know, one of the youngest and most inexperienced in the Gulf, you know, I could hide because I knew in their culture or whatever was obviously a very seniority and hierarchical sort of led, and I could hide behind the fact that it was entirely believable to them when I said, look, I'm only 24, you know, I don't know any of that stuff. Nobody tells me that stuff, you know, and that sort of stuff was entirely acceptable to them, even though, as an insatiably curious, you know, QI wannabe, you know, I actually wanted to know everything that was going on. So yeah.
Do you think you?
It was a bit agricultural, really, but you know, nonetheless, that was, you know, thankful when it ended.
Do you think you'd have resisted less resolutely had you been older?
I'm not sure that would have made a difference, JB. I think, you know, other people drew strength from different things, whether that's, you know, family, children. You know, I mean, I remember having this conversation, and one of the things that I thought was, you know, if you were there in that situation with children,
yeah,
that must have been a massive concern and a worry. And of course it was, but equally it was also, you know, a great sense of strength in terms of, you know, I remember having this conversation with Robbie and one of the American prisoners of war, a guy called Guy Hunter. You know, their sort of point of view on that was that they had family to leave behind. You know, their lives meant something. You know, I was still the sort of single bachelor who, you know, was just flying aeroplanes and stuff, and that was my life, you know. So people drew different things from it and stuff, and drew strength from different areas, really.
Had you kind of lost track of time whilst you were in there, or were you kind of aware of how long it had been?
So not at that stage, James. I sort of knew the days and was pretty accurate. But later on, and you know, again, sort of, you know, zipping through the story a little bit. But later on, I was held in solitary confinement in a cell which was pitch black. So for three weeks, I was in a cell, solitary confinement, pretty much pitch black. The only light I ever got was if they opened the hatch or whatever to give me some food or for whatever reason. And then sometimes there was a tiny crack where there was a water pipe that came out of the wall. There was a tiny crack, and sometimes I sort of looked at it, and it was obviously indirect light anyway, but, you know, sometimes it looked a little bit lighter or darker or whatever. But during that period, because it was pitch black, the main way that I kept my calendar was by the air raids, because I knew the air raids happened at night.
Oh,
my word. It's a sequence of air raids close together and then a long gap. I knew that was a day. But actually, during the war, there was a period of 3 days when there was a ceasefire whilst they tried to negotiate a peace settlement. And I think the sort of Russian president was involved in that, Gorbachev and stuff. And there was that process where there were no air raids for 3 days. When eventually I came out of that, I was 3 days out in my mental calendar because, you know, I just had no way of, you know, cause no way of marking time, nothing at all. Absolutely. You know, I say that was really difficult mentally. That was really difficult to be in that.
So just to step back again. So you said you'd answered the questions and the beating stopped, and then you've mentioned that solitary confinement. So my question was, so once the beatings had stopped, clearly you'd taken a pasting already from not answering the questions. But after that point, did you not get physically tortured again?
So not routinely, like they say. There was one occasion, you know, which was a sort of a bit of a beating, and other sort of, you know, smaller occasions where you'd you know, we just get a bit of sort of physical treatment and stuff, but there were no more sort of that, you know, what could be described as torture in terms of interrogations and stuff. So that was you know, that was it for that.
Why did they put you into solitary confinement then? What was,
you know, that's, I don't know. Well, first of all, I do know in that we were taken to the, that's a good answer, isn't it? I don't know, I do know. But we were taken to what was the Ba'ath Party Intelligence Headquarters, which was this high security facility. And there were also actually sort of three bunkers, which eventually get blown up. But we were taken to this facility, and we were all put into solitary confinement. But as far as I know, I was the only one that didn't have any light, and I think it was just bad luck. So, you know, for many, many years, I thought I'd been singled out for whatever reason for bad treatment. But actually, fairly recently, I mean, literally only a couple of years ago, sort of found out that in effect, what had happened is the building that had been having some work done on it. And there was the tarpaulin had sort of fallen over and actually was blanking out, you know, any light going into my cell because I was at the end of the corridor. So everybody else had a window, and the guys will talk about, you know, staring out over the window in the window and watching the air raids over Baghdad and stuff. And I could never work out why, you know, why I was singled out. And I think it was just unlucky. So I don't think there was any rhyme or reason to, but I even find that out a few
times. Hey, so Wado, you mentioned other people, and you mentioned a pair of boots. When was the first contact you actually had with anyone else who was in the same predicament as you?
So the first real contact. So, well, again, there's lots of bits of the story, but there was one point. So after the interrogations, you know, very quickly, I get taken to a hospital. They operate on my elbow under a general anaesthetic, you know, which is interesting in itself, wondering whether you're ever going to wake up. But they operate under a general anaesthetic onto my elbow. And then after that, I'm taken to another prison where the rest of the sort of prisoners of war are. And I'm placed in a cell next to this guy called Guy Hunter. And at night, we're in solitary confinement, but at night we're sort of whispering to each other, you know, sort of almost leaning up against the door or whatever. But we're only there for, I think, I'm only there for one night, and then we're moved into this Ba'ath Party intelligence headquarters, and where we go to solitary confinement. And then there's no way of communicating with anybody at all. So, you know, that's back into solitary confinement for several weeks. Eventually, that prison or the prison complex gets bombed. I think it's the 23rd of February. It gets hit by a raid by a couple of 117s who take out the bunkers that are part of the complex. And half of the building that we're in falls down as well. Not the half that we're in, fortunately. So, you know, pretty sure that all of the prisoners of war, allied prisoners of war, are accounted for. Remembering that there are Iraqi prisoners in the prison as well. So, you know, they're not all accounted for. And some of the guards are killed in that as well. But as far as we knew, all of the allied POWs, you know, were okay and got out of that. And so they then that night have to move us into the prison that becomes famous many years later because of, you know, mistreatment. So they move us to Abu Ghraib. And we're in a cell in Abu Ghraib, but at this point we're five or six to a cell for one night, which is wonderful, absolutely wonderful. You know, till at one point actually, you know, sort of after several hours of listening to John Nicol, we have to tell him to be quiet and stuff. and everyone's swapping all these stories or whatever, and that's suddenly where it dawns on me, because until that moment I thought everybody else is in the same conditions. So it's only then that I realized that everybody else has had a window. So nobody else has been in the pitch black for 3 weeks and also been at the end of the corridor. You know, the food had generally run out by the time it got to me and a US guy called Jeff Tice, who we were right at the end, and Mohammed, who was the Kuwaiti pilot, we were right at the end of the corridor. So often there was none left by the time it got to us or whatever. So, and also the other big thing is, you know, most of the others are still in their flying suits, and I'm in a dish dash that has been given to me at the hospital. So, you know, I have no shoes, just a dish dash, you know, and everyone else has got their flying boots and flying suits and stuff, you know. And it was a case of feeling a little bit sorry for myself and stuff. And Robbie, bless him, so at Abu Ghraib, the head of the prison or somebody came round and he gave us dates and hot tea, which was fantastic, you know, and sort of starving or whatever, and some pita bread, you know, and Robbie, bless him, sort of had half of his pita bread and stuff, and then gave me the other half of his pita bread, because, you know, he'd had these stories and he realised what a sort of hard time we'd still been having at the end of the corridor and stuff. So bless him, you know, he sort of shared his food and on that day. But it was fantastic to be together for one night, five or six of us. And Mohammed, the Kuwaiti pilot, was with us. And he was able to translate, you know, what had been being said on the Iraqi radio, because, of course, we couldn't understand it. You know, they used to play this radio in the Black Force Intelligence Headquarters, but no idea what was happening. So, it was fantastic to have that contact. Because after an experience like that, people need to speak about it, and they need to speak about it to others who can understand what they've been through. So that was wonderful for one night.
And so there's not much left of captivity after that point, if you're talking sort of middle of February, if you end up being released around the March time. So, yeah, you know, so, did it ease off at that point? Does it start getting a little bit easier?
Yeah, it's sort of easier in many ways and harder in others. So, you know, at that point, I develop gastroenteritis, which is difficult when you're locked in a cell all day, you know, and you're allowed out to go to the loo once a day and stuff. So that's a little bit tricky, but that's a different story. And then John Nicol sort of, you know, takes a real severe beating there for trying to speak to the Iraqi or signal the Iraqi prisoners that are sort of across the courtyard, and a few other things happen in that. So it doesn't get easy, but it gets a little bit easier for me in terms of not being in, not, well, we're back in solitary confinement, but not being in the dark, you know, sort of think that, you know, I can survive this night for a period where I really questioned how long I could survive in solitary confinement, in a tiny cell in the dark for, you know, however long without going mad. So, yeah. And then eventually we're taken to a military prison. which is where we're released from. And then the sort of the morning of release, you know, this guy comes round to the cell and says, you know, Mr. David, the war is over. We can be friends now. You're going home. And shortly after that, I get delivered the sort of yellow suits that we were all released in. So for me, that's fantastic because I haven't had any clothes until that point. You know, for the others, obviously, that's the point they lose their flying suits and stuff and get put in a yellow suit. But yeah, and then that was, you know, the point was, well, can we believe this? What is really going to happen to us and stuff? So, but sure enough, yeah, it was a genuine release. We get handed over to the Red Cross and then from there, fly home.
Wow. What was the Red Cross reception? How do they sort of greet you and look after you?
So we were handed over into the Novotel in Baghdad, and the Red Cross obviously were doing the best that they could, but clearly there's no sort of protection and stuff. And you know, one of the, you know, the guy who's now known as Andy McNabb or whatever, you know, we're sort of chewing the cud a little bit with him, and you know, he points out that there's nothing that we can do if they decide to come and take us back into captivity. Yeah, you know, so not to put a damper on things, but just to put a bit of realism on things. And the Red Cross then delivers some food, and basically the only thing they could rustle up was some beer, interestingly enough, some eggs, and some chocolate. So, and Rhonda Cornham, who was the medic who was shot down in the Black Hawk, she was a major at the time, and she warned us against, you know, drinking beer or eating chocolate or eggs or whatever, because we wouldn't be able to cope with it. But of course, you know, we couldn't resist the temptation. So one might say the atmosphere turned green and could be cut with. But you know, it was great to, you know, have a little bit of comfort in that. And then we were supposed to be released. We were supposed to be taken out to the airport that night, but that gets delayed by a day. So now we're sort of thinking about, well, what's really going on here? Because the weather wasn't great, which was, you know, justifiable and turned out to be the legitimate reason. But, you know, sort of worried about whether, you know, actually this is going to happen or not. So it was, you know, great to actually get on the aeroplane. And, you know, the feeling as it lifts off from the tarmac, you know, Swiss Air aeroplanes leased by the Red Cross or whoever, you know, as these aeroplanes get airborne from Baghdad, was just amazing. And literally, we must have been, I don't know, 100 feet. And I think it was a couple of F-15s or whatever come up onto the wing to escort us out there. And then, you know, soon after, there was some F-3s that came up as well. Just fantastic.
Oh, wow. Who did your squadron send to meet you?
So they sent, it's really interesting and very sad, actually. So there was some confusion about who was alive and who wasn't.
Oh.
And so they sent people who could recognize people as they came off the aeroplane. So for myself and Robbie, there was two guys, a guy called Frank Waddington, no relation, but he was one of the squadron leaders or whatever, and a guy called Mark Rudder, who were our sort of greeters, you know, off the aircraft. And I always felt a little bit sorry for them, actually, because, you know, of course, they'd been through the war. They'd done all of it and stuff. And, you know, but actually, no, they were just lost, because obviously all of the focus was on the prisoners of war and stuff, you know, and their stories. And I think still, actually, many of the stories about, you know, people who'd done the 30-odd missions and stuff by that stage through the war is often sort of in the shadows of the stories about what happened to us as POWs. But, you know, I think it's an important thing. You know, I mean, I'd far rather later on in my career, obviously, I go do the QA course and got a data brief summary. But, you know, I'd far rather be sort of, you know, one of the ones that did 30-odd missions and stuff than, you know, a prisoner of war. So, you know, you take strength from whatever happens to you and stuff. But you know, I do say that, you know, we were a small part of it. But we got, you know, exponentially more focus and attention than anybody else, understandably so. But you know, we shouldn't forget that people had their own battles, you know, flying 30-odd missions and stuff.
Can I ask this? We had John Bell on, who flew for 617 Squadron, And when I listened to his story, one of the things which struck me was the commanding officers who were on the ground every day were just sending lads out. Well, I say just sending, I didn't mean it in that way, but they were giving lads orders to go and do things knowing that they probably wouldn't return. Given your experience, did that change how you thought about commands that you gave and jobs that you gave the lads, missions and so forth?
I think, you know, so you're there for a purpose, and you know, we're all volunteers, and you sign up and you know that it's going to be risky. Even training is risky. Hopefully not James, but the rest of us on this call would have lost good friends through training accidents and things, you know, through our careers. So you know that, you know, and we all do it because, you know, we sort of love that excitement and stuff, and accepted the risk. And that's the same when you go on operations as well. So the first thing is we're all volunteers. But I think the thing that it did really drive home for me, and again, going back to sort of the beginning of what we spoke about here, was that, you know, I always wanted, as a force commander or squadron commander or whatever, to make sure that anybody who was going to go into harm's way was as best prepared as we reasonably could make them. Mm. So we couldn't spend many times or whatever getting better equipment and stuff. I mean, there was a whole process to try and do that and whatever, but we couldn't suddenly magic up a few billion to have a bit of better kit here or there or whatever. But with what we had and the constraints that we were under, just making sure that the people were as best prepared as possible. So, you know, if they hadn't had the exposure to the training that they needed, we'll send somebody else. You know, so we're a big force, we're a big community or whatever. So, you know, unless it was absolutely critical. So just doing, you know, the small bit that I could to make sure that that was done. And, you know, of course, I didn't do that in later life, didn't do that sort of hands-on stuff. That was all done through my headquarters and stuff, and, yeah, you know, making sure that we had the right training programs, we bid for the right stuff, or indeed having difficult conversations with senior commanders about what we couldn't do, which didn't always go down well, but, you know, not being afraid to have that fight, even if it didn't do me any personal good, but just being honest about it.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I don't know what I was expecting you to say there. I don't know whether I was expecting you to say something like, you know, maybe as more cautious than I otherwise would be, maybe as more thoughtful about the things which we did. But I do very much like the answer, well, we just became as prepared as we could, because, of course, that's exactly what you would do.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there was, you know, the point is nobody needed ever to convince me again that you know, whenever we're taking risks, you know, bad things can happen to good people. And sometimes, actually, you know, because we are naturally risk takers as a community. Otherwise, you don't fly a fast jet or indeed any, you know, a helicopter in James's case or whatever at 0-6 and stuff and over difficult terrain and, you know, landing in dusty conditions or whatever. So you don't do what we do without being naturally a risk taker compared to the normal population or whatever. And sometimes that can get the better of us. And so there were occasions in, you know, particularly actually when I was the boss of 9 Squadron, where sometimes I'd have to rein people back and remember that, you know, there is a risk. So don't take liberties with a hard deck that we've been given or anything like that, just because, you know, you don't sense any risk or whatever. You know, you're not going to win the war by being a tiny bit brave in that stuff and then, you know, getting shot down or whatever. So there were occasions like that where yeah, that absolutely sort of came in and said, no, hang on a minute. You know, we don't need to take this risk, so let's not take it. Because otherwise, we might be naturally inclined to do it.
Do all your colleagues know what you've been through? And I don't mean people like Godders who you're subsequently friends with. I mean, you know, when you just show up at a new job, were they all aware of who you are and what you've done, or do you have to tell them that at a later date?
So I never sort of really tell them, as Godders mentioned, you know, unless I'm specifically asked to or whatever. But, you know, I think there's a point that I didn't really want to be sort of known or indeed asked for any sort of particular sympathy or I'm not sure what the right word would be, but, you know, the POW stuff was something that happened. It's in the past. I'll tell you about it if you're really interested, or I'll tell you about it if I'm asked to, in terms of certain situations of, you know, preparing other people for realities of conflict or whatever. But you know, that's not really relevant to you know, say, sort of walking onto a squadron as the force commander and say, right, you know, before you say anything else, listen to me. I'm going to tell you about what happened to me. You know, it's, so it's something, you know, really has to be asked about. I'm not shy in telling people about it, but you know, the reason it sort of always has to be asked for, you know, I'll never force it down anyone's neck or whatever of saying, right, let me tell you my story type stuff, you know, before you tell me yours.
Dave, do you still get together with, you know, boys who are POWs with you, the two Johns, Rupert Clark, etc.? They're sort of informal booze-ups and you were...
Even formal booze-ups as well. So, silver linings and all of that sort of stuff. So, you know, I think like with Robbie Stewart, my navigator, you know, would have come across each other in the squadron, but, you know, we were in different worlds really and stuff, and never, you know, I would imagine that we would never have formed a sort of a close relationship in other circumstances. But because of this, we are very close. Robbie's the sort of godfather to my son, and you know, we've kept in touch very closely, and you know, clearly been mostly proud of what Kirsty was doing. Got to fly with her in the Red Arrows, you know, so I gave her a few hints and tips on formation keeping and stuff. But you know, just magical moments actually, which were just fantastic. And indeed, with everybody else, so we get together once a year, but we keep in regular contact, you know, via emails or other occasions and stuff, or when we bump into each other. So it is a community that's survived, you know, through the ages, even though, you know, we're different characters, we're doing different things and stuff, but it is something that still binds us. And
yeah, you know, fantastic.
The linings are the sort of relationships and friendships that you make that you otherwise wouldn't.
Goodness me. Well, boys, have you got any more questions? I mean, I'm sure I could come up with lots and lots more, but my word.
Yeah, so, flipping brilliant, Watto. You know, I mentioned at the beginning, and you just covered it there, that, you know, unless you know, you don't know. But then, you know, so I purposely stayed away from any detail with these guys who may have known it in the past. But again, you know, where I mentioned that people's jaws hit the floor with the, I guess, the sort of clarity and, you know, it's not matter of fact, you do bring it to life. But the fact that every single one of us are putting ourselves in the situation that you're putting yourselves in. You know, we talked right at the beginning there about the, you know, the trepidation of going out and doing your job in the first place. But then you get into a situation that none of the rest of us hear, and I would presume that 99.999% of the people listening to this as well have never had to, you know, have never been in, where they're always talking survival, you know, is that will to survive that you mentioned a few times, you know, so as well as that sort of being tested in your job, you've been unbelievably tested in life in terms of getting through all this all, whether it's, you know, being beaten, whether it's dislocated, you know, operating table. I mean, everything you mentioned there is unbelievable when you put yourself in that situation and think, what would I have done? You know, clearly, I'm sure the boys will be telling me afterwards that I'll have been sat in the comfy chair with a big cigar telling them everything within about 10 minutes, having a glass of wine. I like to think I wouldn't, but I'm sure I'd get there before Mason did. But, you know, just I know we've gone on longer than we normally would with an episode, but I think this one is 100% worth it, and just a massive thanks for talking us through the experience, and opening up like that. It's been brilliant. Thank you.
It's been amazing. Yes, fantastic to listen to. And I had my, you probably tell I was talking to someone because I had my family alongside as well. Come and listen to this, and it's just been fascinating. And I know from when you've spoken to us tonight, clearly there's probably much more detail that you've gone into, but I think the picture you've painted is even though I knew a little bit of what you went through, I didn't know that much and haven't heard it from yourself. And so I'm now one of the people with my jaw on the floor, and it's been amazing to listen to.
Thanks, Nick. Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to, you know, chat with people who've been there and done that, or not quite that, but you know, similar sort of thing. So yeah,
thank
always,
God.
Always fun to chat. So and you know, look forward to getting our first space person on Mars, Goddard, eh? So you know, you move.
Well, so things. That is a good segue for another episode.
Is it going to be you, Goddard? Me. Yeah.
No, actually, I did have a look at the astronaut application today and was fully up, meet all the requirements, bar a master's in some sort of engineering degree. So I've got kippered at the first post. Never mind.
I asked Harv the other day, I can't remember if we spoke about it, but it was just a week after my birthday. And they said, no, they've put an age limit on it of 49. Not that I have a master's in anything either.
Yeah. So, yeah. Your two A levels don't wouldn't really hack it.
Well, just before we conclude this, Dave, have you got anything you want? Any corporate message that you want to plug?
No, definitely no sort of corporate. You know, I suppose the point is, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, the name of the company that I work for, but yeah, you know, I think it's good to still be involved and you know, tread that sort of corporate world between. Understanding, you know, when we talk to the sort of financiers and the budgeteers and stuff and about margins and all this sort of stuff, but understand that what we're actually doing is, you know, as James is about to go and experience, is that we're training people to go into harm's way, basically. So, you know, we've got to do that in the right way, and that's not a plug for my company. I think that's the point for any of us to move out to the industry. Is, you know, we've spent 30 years in the Air Force, so, you know, that's my vocation. Just bringing the two together, I think, is the best thing that I can do now. And, you know, make sure that that people benefit from the sort of best that industry has got to offer. In our case, obviously, training technologies and, you know, mission support and stuff like that. But yeah, not a plug for CAE per se, but that's what we all need to keep.
I guess one of the things you mentioned there is it's been brilliant to have James along today, you know, and a massive congratulations for getting through with Skull Crusher in the first place and going on. But I think flipping brilliant that, you know, two generations of aviators are sat there. We can see them here, sat on the couch listening to this together and you know, still having the same reaction. So a really good pilot episode in the end.
Yeah.
Thanks, Waddo. And thanks, James.
The worst episode, Dave or James, you know, with Fly Me Dunk. It's probably about the same.
Right.
Yeah, I was just laughing at the beginning because Doug, when he said, well, we were doing the nav test, or was it a final handling test or whatever, I think, crikey, your instructor didn't even know which test.
Yeah, no idea.
That didn't matter no by idea. That point.
So right. You obviously didn't get lost and you handled the aeroplane very well. So congratulations, James, and good luck for the future.
You're not supposed to do it on the, but we did a few loops and rolls, didn't we, James? We found a bit of time at the end just to, because he's not going to be able to do an helicopter. So we thought we'd better go turn upside.
Well, if everything goes to plan.
Yeah.
Not intentionally.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well,
right, take us out, JB.
Let's leave it there. Thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Go find us at Pilot Episodes Pod. You can find Goddard's. So, are you still on Twitter, or have you come off now, Goddard's? You still there?
Yeah, yeah. I just have to be careful because anything I tweet appears in the Daily Mail for some reason.
Yeah, Goddard's is no longer on Twitter, so don't.
Next to a great big picture of you with a great big grin on your face.
Don't. I keep forgetting yours. Your Major Dunk. Dunk Major.
At Doug Major.
I'm Doug Major, and I'm at J Beardmore. So until next time, when we'll see you with some more pilot episodes.
Step onto the legendary clay courts of Roland Garros, where the world's best players battle it out at the French Open for a chance to win a Grand Slam title. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. See the action unfold as legends fight for glory and new rivalries emerge. Daily live coverage begins Monday, May 20th, with match replays on demand so you never miss a moment. From the first serve to the final point, Roland Garros promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history. Stream now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything.
With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamline my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.